This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge and pay our respect to elders past and present.
From there, the story grew in his mind that he was going to create this world of car gangs and car stunts and car crashes.
I wonder if we'll have a turn in Australian filmmaking that is like, actually, let's all admit we're from the suburbs, they're dull, they're boring, they're daggy, and you need a car to get around.
Petrol guzzling V8s, scintillating car chases. Crazed gangs who wreak havoc across the Australian desert. That's right, it's Mad Max, the 1979 dystopian thriller that remains a standout of Australian New Wave cinema. It follows the saga of police officer Max Rokitansky, who loses everything and then heads off in his GT Falcon to seek revenge.
Ruined dreams, this wasted land.
Across four separate films, we watch as Max becomes embroiled in otherworldly battles set amid a volatile social order. Resources like oil and water are in short supply, with heat waves and dust storms making the natural world increasingly inhospitable. In the most recent film, Fury Road, we're introduced to Furiosa, a hardened road warrior who sets out to rescue five women enslaved by the terrifying ruler of the wasteland, Immortan Joe. I'm Dylan Bird, and this is Seeing Green, a podcast exploring how Australian cinema has shaped our relationship to our natural environment. In this episode, we're taking a fresh look at the Mad Max series, with a focus on the latest film, 2015's Fury Road. We're exploring what this film reveals about Australian car culture, resource extraction, and the disastrous consequences that await if we don't act on climate change. To do this, we're bringing together two experts from different fields. Joining me in this discussion is our film expert, PhD candidate in the School of Media, Film and Journalism at Monash University, Melanie Ash. Welcome, Melanie.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me.
And I'm particularly excited to have you as part of today's discussion because your research is so relevant to Mad Max. Tell us about what you're studying.
My research is sort of looking at the region around Broken Hill in New South Wales. And many people might not know this, but it's one of the kind of largest or biggest filming zones for outdoor shooting locations, has this huge history of film that have sort of been made there since the 70s. So I'm looking at that region and the films that have come out of there. You know, the region plays a huge role in Australia's history as a mining economy. You know, it's sort of the birthplace of Australia's mining history in a lot of ways. So I'm looking at these two industries and kind of thinking about how they overlap through representation, how the outback in these films is represented on screen, and how the mining industry is kind of played into that.
Yeah, wow. Well, a lot to work with for a PhD by the sound of things. We're also joined today by Dr. Catherine Lucas-Healy, a research fellow at the Australian National University with a diverse background spanning architectural design, renewable energy and electric vehicles. And she's also an avid film goer. Great to have you here, Kat. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Very excited to be here.
And your official bio says that you've got 15 years experience working on all manner of energy related things. Give us a quick snapshot of your research interests and background.
Sure. I guess I'm looking at the same thing from lots of different angles, or maybe I just don't have a very long attention span. So I've been sort of on the side of like working in the design of buildings and trying to make them more sustainable. What can the government do to sort of help people to use less energy, but also meet their all the things that they need to do. And at the moment, I'm working with ANU on a project where we're looking at, if we have lots and lots of electric vehicles suddenly everywhere, we're switching from kind of a petrol station model to having to rely on the electricity grid to sort of get our quote unquote fuel. We're looking at a project that's trying to use the batteries within the electric vehicles to help support the grid. And I'm looking at the social aspects of that. So we're sort of trialling it with a fleet. The cars are used by community nurses and government staff and that sort of thing. And so when the cars aren't being used, they get plugged in and then suddenly they're like a grid battery.
Wow, so cars as an energy source.
Yeah, yeah. It's a reimagining of the car, really. And we don't know if people would be even interested in doing that, or they might be really interested in doing that.
Yeah, well, I suppose a reimagining of the car is something that, you know, watching the Mad Max film definitely, or the films, I should say, definitely implores us to do. Let's dive into our discussion. Melanie, can you provide some context around Mad Max? How did the film, the original film that is, come about?
Yeah, well, it's a funny story, actually. Apparently, George Miller, the director of all the Mad Max movies, used to work in the medical profession, and he, you know, he was working in hospital and seeing all these car crash victims come in, apparently, and sort of from there the story grew in his mind that he was going to create this world of car gangs and car stunts and car crashes. I think the whole post-apocalyptic civil collapse world grew from having to deal with people who had car crashes in a medical setting.
Yeah, wow. And Kat, what's been your experience with Mad Max? Do you remember when you first saw the film and what captivated you about it initially?
I think my initial connection with Mad Max is we used to tape all the music videos off the TV, and there was these tapes that we used to just watch repeatedly, and it had the Tina Turner film clip that had all the Beyond Thunderdome footage in it. And so a lot of, when I think of Mad Max, I totally think about that.
Yeah, and watching them in sequence, is there anything that struck you about how the different films depict the natural environment and the landscape that sort of serves as a really dramatic backdrop for the films?
I think that they're each very much of their time, because the original Mad Max is sort of, it's 1979, isn't it? So it's really about that kind of rev head culture. There's lots of sort of technologies that are really everyday things to us now, like we see solar panels all the time and wind farms when you go for a drive in the country and that sort of thing. They're really absent from all of them. But I guess when the first one came out, that didn't feel like an absence, whereas it felt like a real absence when I rewatched Fury Road.
I was kind of struck rewatching them recently that a lot of them, even the earlier ones, do kind of use alternate models of energy. Like in the third one, there's a factory where they're using methane from pigs to like run the Thunderdome town or whatever. And so it's interesting that, you know, this kind of model of scarcity and creating energy from unusual things has been on the mind of these films, even though they're kind of just background details a lot of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And how significant is the story of mining, extraction and depleting resources to the film setting, given that I think it's a second film, Road Warrior, that's actually filmed in Broken Hill? How has that informed the approach and the plot of Mad Max, Melanie?
I mean, I think the idea of land extraction is in the background of all these films, just in this sort of idea of apocalypse. I know the latest film talks about thermonuclear apocalypse, but it's always just kind of an assumption rather than anything that's explored in detail. But what is interesting in the second film, which is shot in Broken Hill, is that the regions that they're shooting in, they really only became developed since, you know, European invasion because of the mining going on in these regions. So the roads that they're filming on are kind of infrastructural roads that were set up by the mining town. So what you're actually seeing in the background is a kind of history of, yeah, quarrying resources from one area to the other out of that region to the port in South Australia where they were launching off from. So in that sense, it's kind of telling a mining story in the background there.
I remember the Road Warrior, the man we called Max. To understand who he was, you have to go back to another time, when the world was powered by the black fuel and the desert sprouted great cities of pipe and steel.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, Mad Max is really all about cars. It's essentially a sort of Western on wheels. There's a story of revenge and retribution as Max struggles to survive in this really challenging landscape. Kat, what's your interpretation of how Mad Max depicts car culture, and I suppose particularly Australian car culture?
So I think that it's actually a really nice thing about Australian car culture is the love and care and maintenance that goes into maintaining these things. Even though they run on dinosaur juice, they're bad for our atmosphere and they're bad for our air quality and stuff like that. But, you know, it's full of community, it's full of learning and this kind of thing, this culture that I think is really, really ingrained. And you see it in heaps of Australian movies.
Got it back off. Engine one is gone. Two's about to blow.
Right. Are you a Blackstar?
Uh-huh.
All right, engine one now.
You're a
Yeah, it's a fascinating point, isn't it? Because black thumb is also a colloquial term for someone who's a really terrible gardener who sort of kills, you know, every plant they touch. So there's an interesting parallel there between someone being really savvy with fixing cars, but also in the process of that and fully embracing this sort of gas guzzling car culture, there is, you know, very serious environmental consequences that come from that. Melanie, what do you make of that idea of repair and the way it's depicted in Mad Max? I suppose, you know, specifically the latest film, Fury Road.
It really is just about what avenues of participation are there in terms of repair, and even not just repair, but the DIY culture around the cars. How do they look? You know, they're just such an eclectic mix of different styles. You've got the kind of big road train style war rig, but, you know, then they'll have popped the top of a VW bug or something. And so you get this kind of very unusual sort of idiosyncratic visual style, which I think shows the kind of gleaning or scavenger-like culture that they're living in. They're kind of making what they can out of what's around. And as a result, yeah, you get these unusual combinations. But something that I've always found really fascinating about these movies, in particular Fury Road, is that you don't see any car parts or car crashes strewn across the desert. And you'd assume there'd have to be these sorts of things, the way that the whole movie is essentially a giant car explosion and a giant car chase. But what I think that kind of visual detail is telling us is that these cultures of repair and kind of recycling and reuse are so intensive in this space that, like, every little scrap is just getting picked up and reused, which I actually find really cool.
I had this really interesting experience. I went to the launch of a new car. It was a very fancy, posh event, but they invited lots of motoring journalists. A lot of them just had these real passion projects where they'd bought an old car, they were restoring it, they had garages full of it, like, and they didn't really care about the new car launch. They just wanted to sit and have a chat about their car restoration projects. And one of them was saying that sort of around about 2000-ish, cars just became way more complex. They're computers just as much as they are cars. And there's this sort of turning point where they become less possible to fix, or they just become too expensive to fix because they're too complex. And so that if you were sort of looking to buy like a secondhand luxury car, you're better off buying an older one than one that's sort of been built in the last 20 years. And I think that that's sort of something that I fear with like electric cars, and they've got heaps of bells and whistles because they're trying to convince people to buy them and that sort of thing. It's like, how much of this is actually repairable, or how much do you have the right to repair as well?
It's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because in this film, there's very much kind of an eco-feminist bent to Fury Road in particular, with the women in the film not killing unnecessarily, you know, being, you know, generally much more peaceful.
Thought somehow you girls were above all that.
Much of the killing is done by men, and also the ancestors of Furiosa in the film are sort of keeping hold of these seedlings, which they hope to harvest and you know, spring new life and have a much more sustainable and green future, if only they could get to a place that has more water and so on.
Seeds.
These are from home. Heirlooms. The real thing. I plant one every chance I get.
Where?
So far, nothing's took. Earth's too sour.
And in the work you're doing, Kat, is there much of an emphasis on that notion of how we can or should be really thinking about broader issues of equality and living within our means? I mean, there's a question as to how many of these exciting new gadgets we all might really need for ourselves. And also, I guess, who can afford these vehicles, which at this stage are still relatively pricey?
It's a very big issue in a number of different ways. You know, you think about the car, people that sort of live right in the outer suburbs that are most car reliant, but it tends to be the lower income areas. And so you have the least ability to be able to use the new technology, maybe save money over the longer term or contribute less to air pollution. And I think it's a massive issue, and it feels like it's always a second thought. And so I think it feels like we're always creating problems and then having to solve them.
Melanie, in Mad Max, in every film really, the environment, the landscape is famously dry. We see the beach depicted in the first film, which is, you know, quite beautiful set, I think, filmed, I should say, on the Surf Coast in Victoria. But we don't see a whole lot of water apart from that, really. What do you make of the way water is depicted and its centrality, I suppose, in particular to Fury Road?
I mean, it's a good question, because I think it's again one of the sort of details of the film that is, it's a background detail. You know, water scarcity is obviously so central to the final film, but where's the water coming from? Its lack of representation shows something just in that kind of dryness. You're getting that detail that there is no water around. The people in power have water in Fury Road. And so I guess it becomes a sort of symbol of the power that they wield. They're high up, so they kind of pour it from above and it splashes down. They have control over the life-giving qualities of water, I suppose.
Do not, my friends, become addicted to water. It will take hold of you, and you will resent its absence.
Water is basically the only reason that the Citadel exists, right? And it's like everything's kind of contracted back and everything's eroded back to this point. And they're like, if you try and get away from the Citadel, all you're doing is going away from the water. And so it's this point of power and control. And I think, I'm going to guess, it doesn't really show you, but that they're using some kind of like hydroelectricity. There's very, very limited use of electricity in it, but it's sort of limited to where the wives, the breeders live. And so I think it's used very symbolically and depict power and control.
And that really sort of ties in with a strong eco-feminist thread in this film, where the women generally don't kill unnecessarily, being generally much more sort of peaceful than men. Much of the killing is done by men. And also the ancestors of Furiosa in the film are safeguarding these seedlings, which they hope to harvest and spring new life. And from there, I suppose, produce a much more hopeful and greener society, if only they could get to a place that has a steady supply of water.
Yeah, that's so interesting as well, because I was thinking about the kind of health and well-being of the people on screen in Fury Road. And it's really the women, the wives, that are kind of in the best health. I think they're really in the position of privilege and being looked after, and kind of everything is saved for their well-being, including luxuries like electricity, as you say.
Well, the war boys, like, they have no future, do they? They believe in Valhalla, and they've all got tumours, and they're all just like kind of indoctrinated into not just accepting but celebrating the fact that they don't have a future, whereas the future totally lies with the water, the wives, the crops.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're sort of saying before, Dylan, like the women don't want to kill, but the men are really only killing each other as well.
I guess there is that kind of somewhat cliche, I suppose, but that sort of feminine representation of regrowth and rebirth and water and life and reproduction and all these things, which is sort of clearly all tying them together as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And also at one point in the film, water is referred to as aquacola. I think it's just before Furiosa speeds off in the war rig, and the war boys are all excited about the fact that the rig is carrying milk and aquacola. I mean, that suggests a commodification of water, doesn't it? Do you see that as feeding into kind of capitalist critique at all that Mad Max expounds either in, you know, the previous films or the most recent one, Fury Road?
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because it's not like the exchange of money ever happens in the Mad Max films. They're always exchanging resources, whether it's gasoline or aquacola or whatnot. But yeah, I do think it's just that classic kind of idea of like, don't sell the sausage, sell the sizzle or whatever it is. When it comes to aquacola, just come up with a funky, cool name for it and people want it more.
Yeah. And what do you make, Kat, of the green place? So this is somewhere that Furiosa is trying to get to with the I think, five wives that she's helping escape from the capital. When they get to, or they pass through the green place without actually knowing it's this muddy wasteland, what's your interpretation of the significance of the green place to Mad Max?
I sort of saw it in terms of when they go past the green place and they get to the tower that the Valkyrie is sitting there in there as bait. And that tower is like it's a transmission tower. So I sort of saw it as this is the edge of reality. Like this is the edge of habitable land, and it's not even really habitable. And so I think it's basically just trying to draw a line of this is as far as people go. There's nothing else out here. The chase out there and back felt kind of like this horizontal bungee jump where you sort of get out to the outer reaches, and where there was once infrastructure, you know, there was once society there. A transmission line is indicating that, and that, like, it's all basically broken and it's all just going to contract back, and just sort of spraying back the bungee cord back to the Citadel.
We're going to the green place of many mothers.
Yeah, it's a great imagery, I think. What do you think, Melanie?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's so true, and just, you know, the whole film is, you know, the film spends so much time on just crossing distance in this kind of horizontal way, like you're talking about, Kat. But then despite, you know, the amount of space they cover, they never reach any, you know, more promising space to be able to inhabit. So they have to go back to where they came from. And it's actually a vertical move that they need to make back up into the Citadel rather than horizontally. There's kind of an interesting kind of class commentary there or something about how, in fact, yeah, they need to topple the hierarchies or something rather than move elsewhere across horizontal space.
The whole thing is just this sort of, it's just multiplying dead ends until you're running out. You're basically running out and realizing there's only one place to go. Everything else is a dead end, even if it didn't used to be. Over time, it's just going to contract back because there isn't a future.
Okay, we're about a half mile of Fanaky Road. You'll see me any minute now.
Rip the guts out of her! Give it the producers!
I think Mad Max has an unusual relationship to Australian landscape because a lot of the films, you know, they have a clear relationship to Australia in the sense that they're filmed here mostly, except for Fury Road, of course. And so they're recognisable, but they're kind of pitched in this sort of non-placey kind of way. It's like, where are they set? It's just a kind of everywhere post-apocalyptic zone. So they've kind of got this unusual referral relation to Australia that's not really there as well. And so in that sense, I think they work well, you know, pitched internationally or to any audience because they're not sort of making a particular claim on place. But in terms of, yeah, making reference to climate change, it's so tricky because I think Fury Road is often kind of raised up as a great example of a kind of warning about climate change, right? It's got like that desertification of land, the water scarcity, nuclear holocaust, you know, collapse of civil society, etc. And everyone's sort of like, this is not where we want to be. This is what we need to watch as a way to heed warning. But at the end of the day, as you say, Kat, there's so many apocalyptic narratives and they're either in this sort of extreme of apocalypse or that other kind of techno-utopian technology will solve everything. And I think the best way to kind of read it is to think somewhere in the middle. And, you know, obviously, no, we don't want to get to where Mad Max is as a society, but what are the kind of, what sort of things can representation open up, like exciting ways to think through possible solutions or whether it's about recycling cultures or new kind of ways of relating to the land that Mad Max might be able to help us to start thinking about.
Absolutely. And I mean, as you said before, Kat, the gas-guzzling, petrol-fueled vehicle is very much part of the Mad Max aesthetic. It's almost a sort of steampunk aesthetic in Fury Road. Do you imagine that a future version of Mad Max, I think there's another film out in 2024 if it comes out when they say it will. I think Fury Road took many, many more years than they initially thought to produce. Could there be a Mad Max that deals with electric vehicles and cars and motorbikes that don't pollute, you know, huge amounts of greenhouse gas into the atmosphere? Would that actually work within the aesthetic of these films?
It's a great question. I was sort of thinking about that when I was watching the film, and I was thinking it's probably petrol punk. Let's call it petrol punk. There were a couple of things. I think when it comes to, like, you know, electric vehicles, but more so maybe things like solar panels and that kind of thing, they're not in the movie because they indicate hope for the future because they can keep generating in perpetuity. There's probably still solar panels that were installed in the 80s that are working in Australia, maybe. They're pretty robust. And so I think, you know, maybe in a future Mad Max, there'll be a place that someone finds where they're actually doing this. And it's like, well, you can actually start building something around this instead of, you know, squeezing it until you're done. The electric vehicles, I wonder how they would go in such a dry and sandy environment. Like, look at the sandstorm that's got, like, you know, static and lightning happening inside it. They might not go so well in that. You might find that the petrol and diesel are going to hold up to it a bit more.
So, that's a fantastic dystopian plot point if it worked out that these electric cars that we're investing so much hope in actually don't work in the landscape that Mad Max depicts.
Yeah, I think it's sort of like the new technologies that are being developed are really dependent on us having like heaps of infrastructure to support them, whether it's the way that they're repaired, the way that they're built, like, you know, they're built in clean environments that are, you know, they're going to be more sensitive to dust and that sort of thing. I think it completely changes things. And if you say, let's say there's a Mad Max where there is a settlement that's like that, I think it would look vastly different.
At the same time, though, I think there's something to be said about the way that they've kind of pushed cars to an extreme in this movie. Like, the way that cars relate with the environment is kind of interesting. They're not just simply, you know, traveling on bitumen, but they're kind of deeply entwined with, and they use the rocks and the cliffs and the sand in kind of interesting ways. Like, they're not just on top of them, if that makes sense. They're kind of entangled. And there's one great scene where, you know, the rig that Furiosa and the gang are on is on fire, but to help douse the flames, that they dip the truck into the sand of the desert, and the sand kind of goes through the engine and gets rid of the car being on fire. And so I think it's sort of interesting the way that they are pushing these vehicles to kind of interact with the landscape around them. And I think that's sort of grown more and more as Mad Max movies have gone on as well.
What about the role of the car in Australian film? Because it was very much central to, you know, Australian New Wave cinema and that Ozploitation genre. Do we still see it represented in a similar way as kind of very much a cultural artifact that obviously, you know, resonates, or at least resonated at some point, with audiences in Australia and obviously further abroad as well?
I mean, look, the car has a strange and continuous power in Australian cinema, and I mean, I think there's many theories about where this could come from, but yeah, whether it's Mad Max or 70s new wave films like The Cars That Ate Paris, or more, yeah, kind of Ozploitation genre picks, of which there are many, many. And I think whether it's continued today, it's still around. I think a lot of, you know, contemporary films kind of make light of it. Or there's a film called Wormwood, which came out a few years ago, which is interesting. It explores alternative energies as well. It's a zombie film, but they actually end up somehow using the zombies as like a fuel alternative. It's like a biofuel that they hack into the car. So I think that's an interesting play on all of this as well.
Yeah, and I mean, Kat, you have a lot of experience researching energy-related things, as you put it. You're also a big fan of films and Australian sort of Ozploitation films as well. What do you think that the role of film is in making us think differently and potentially more productively about alternative energy sources and how we can build a better future that's less reliant on fossil fuels?
I don't know. Personally, I don't really want to watch preachy films. I'd rather watch trash, to be honest. When I think of like car culture in film, the first one that comes to mind is Dead End Drive-In, which is the Ozploitation one, and it's all blokes fixing their cars and Sheilas with big hair, and it's about sort of young people getting trapped inside a drive-in to clean up society. And so in Australian film, it's sort of linked to the suburbs, you know, what it's like to be someone from the suburbs. And I don't know, maybe we are still making films about that, or maybe because we're all from the suburbs, we find it too boring. I wonder if we'll have a turn in Australian filmmaking that is like, actually, let's all admit we're from the suburbs. They're dull, they're boring, they're daggy, you know, and you need a car to get around.
What I would add is that I'd like to emphasise just how sort of integrated car culture and petro cultures more generally are in the backdrop of the film. And I think it's a real testament to the costume designer and the set designer. There's just so much intricate detail, you know, whether it's the kind of car badges as talismans on Immortan Joe's outfit, which is also made of plastic. I think there's a real attention to plastic. It's very sparsely used in the film, but of course plastic is birthed from oil. It's part of car culture more broadly, and I think putting that on the villain of the film is a really great way to kind of indicate how the people who have access to the oil are in positions of power as well. And so whether it's steering wheels as a kind of religious object on the backdrop of the set, or car doors used as regular doors in the kind of setting of Immortan Joe's palace, I think there's just really great attention to detail about how central car culture is to this society. I mean, it's worshipped, it's revered. And I think that's a really fantastic detail about the film.
Yeah, and Max's Falcon being refashioned after it's blown up in the opening scene. And at one point, Max says, "That's my car, that's mine." So there's this real identification with one's wheels, which of course, you know, many of them need to survive.
Here we go, girls.
That's mine.
As we kind of look forward into the future, I think you have to sort of understand how long older technologies hang around, maybe forever. New technology, it has this effect of making things more complicated. And that can be a bit difficult for a lot of us, I think, is that it feels like everything's just getting more complex and, you know, things are moving too fast and that kind of thing. And so I think it's a nice thought experiment, and maybe it's a nice idea for another movie again, is like what's sort of like a clean electric future that is actually tactile and tangible, and that we can fix ourselves and that we can build ourselves and that sort of thing without needing, you know, highly qualified, you know, people and really advanced manufacturing facilities and all this kind of thing. Can we make solar panels ourselves?
Yeah, that's so interesting as well, just thinking, because, you know, always on film, repair is always shown to be grungy. It's always dirty, and it's always in that sort of context. So I'd love to see, a kind of more recognisable, you know, middle class version of repair, or, you know, on screen, something that's definitely missing.
Yeah, and empowering us to have those skills as well, not making out like it's too difficult, too specialised. And also underpinning all of that, of course, is a big profit-making machine. There's clear incentives in making things difficult or impossible for the layperson to repair as well.
Pretty much all we get is just the nerd who helps the superhero get these really badass fighting like gear, where they've got some kind of hideout. And I get these all mixed up because I just watched way too many like superhero and Van Damme movies all at once. And so they're all the same movie to me now. But basically, you've got a hideout. You've got like a nerd with no social skills who makes these things. Same as the James Bond thing. You open the room. Oh my God, look at all these weapons. And it's like, what about like a maker culture? What about a maker lab where people are like creating useful things and not just weapons?
Well, it's been so much fun having you both today. I've learned a lot, and I'm never going to watch Mad Max in the same way again, I don't think. I'm really looking forward to the next film when it does arrive, and maybe we can reconvene and unpack all the interesting themes coming out of that. Melanie Ash, Dr. Kat Lucas-Healy, thanks so much for your time. It's been a whole lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Seeing Green is made at Swinburne University of Technology and Monash University, and is supported by an Australian Research Council Discovery Grant. Our executive producers are Professor Therese Davis and Associate Professor Belinda Smale. Production and mixing by Britta Jorgensen. Music by Ash Sterling, and hosted by me, Dylan Bird. In the next episode of Seeing Green...
It definitely feels like one of those movies that was always around me and in my orbit kind of growing up, even though I don't have a singular memory of sitting down and watching it.
As a sort of representative of a new generation of Australia, I feel like we're being asked to see that there's another way.